This is Monocle on Design, Monocle's weekly show on the best in architecture, industrial design, graphics and fashion. I'm Josh Fennett. On today's show, we continue our extended interview series with luminaries in the world of design. In the past few weeks, we've brought you in-depth discussions touching on the life and work of architect Sir Terry Farrell and the graphic design maestro Irma Boom. Today, we meet the New York-based Austrian-born graphic designer Stefan Sagmeister. Sagmeister rose to prominence in the 1990s and was one of the first to take CD covers seriously as design objects. This decision saw him accompany some of the industry's best artists with recognizable creations for the likes of Lou Reed, Brian Eno, and the Rolling Stones. Since then, his studio, Sagmeister & Walsh, has completed work, including head-turning covers for the New York Times magazine and playful ads for the like of New York retailer Barney's, car firm Kia, and the energy provider EDP. Not to mention a use of envelope-pushing typography throughout his work. Monocle's former producer, Henry Reese Sheridan, spoke to Stefan Sagmeister in the latter's apartment last week in New York's Meatpacking District.
My name is Stefan Sagmeister. I am an Austrian designer who lives and works in New York City.
And how long have you been here for in New York?
I think it's gonna get close to 30 years now. Yeah, I originally first came right after graduation for a holiday. And then I came to study here to do a master's degree at Pratt Institute in Brooklyn in 86. Stayed for 3 years, went back to Austria, then to Hong Kong, and then came back in 93 and have been here ever since.
Where were you born precisely? And what kind of family did you grow up in? What kind of childhood did you have?
Well, I grew up in a small town called Bregenz in the very, very western part of Austria, very close to the border of Switzerland and Germany. 5 miles from each border. It's a pretty small town, 25,000 people on a lake within the mountains with a very substantial cultural offering. There is a big music festival there on the lake. So it's a good place to grow up. I am the youngest of 6 kids, 3 boys and 3 girls, and we grew up above a store. My parents had a clothing store that, you know, was sort of the big clothing store in the small town. And growing up, I hated being above the store because you always had to wait. You could never just talk to mom and dad. You always had to wait until they were done, you know, with some client or with somebody who bought something. And of course, most dinner and lunch conversations somehow evolved about around the store. I think my dad was forced by his dad to take over the store, and his dad was forced by his dad to take over the store. So I think by the time, considering both of my brothers went into the store, I could pretty much choose whatever I wanted. And I knew fairly early on, I would say roughly at 15, that I wanted to do something with design because I had started to write for a magazine, and it turned out that I actually enjoyed doing the layout for that magazine much better than the writing.
So this magazine was Alporn, is that correct?
You know everything.
And my understanding is that it was a kind of a left-wing, youth-oriented, yes, Austrian magazine. Yeah. Tell me a little bit more about it. Who was it aimed at, and how did you end up working on it at the age of 15, 16?
Well, it was a young people's magazine, mostly run by high schoolers and some students. It had the proud print run of 1,000. We sometimes got it printed, but we also had a printing machine, so sometimes we attempted to print it ourselves, but we were terrible printers, so it looked better when we didn't print it ourselves. And it was, I think the subtitle was called The Magazine for the Provinces, sort of like for the rural or for a rural space, that sort of thing. But the magazine was also quite culturally active, as in, you know, organized anything from demonstrations to festivals to concerts and things. And all of these things required a steady flow of some sort of graphic items, which, considering I was already doing the layout, I also did. And sort of like learned about the process of design, but also about, very importantly, about its function. Like, I found it endlessly fascinating that you could, you know, design a poster, put that up, and 1,000 people would show up on a festival, pretty much because there was no other media available, pretty much on account of that poster. And that I found a wonderful line of work to pursue. Then moving to Vienna soon after high school graduation and applying to the University for Applied Arts, where I promptly did not make the entry exam. And I went for a year into sort of like a smaller art school and basically trained myself in that year to retake that entry exam. And then the second time it worked.
Tell me about your kind of formal design education in some more detail. What was the course like when you got onto it? What did it involve? And did you enjoy yourself?
Well, the University for Applied Arts definitely was the most prestigious sort of like design school in Austria. I think it still is. And they have a number of countries in Central Europe. I think Germany has it as well. Oh, I know that Germany has it as well, sort of a masterclass system, meaning that you basically apply with one professor and then you stick with that same professor throughout the 4 years. In my case, the professor was Paul Schwartz, who was a accomplished and I think fairly prominent designer in the 1950s. There was an opportunity in Vienna that four students from the Schwartz class, we convinced the director of the Schauspielhaus, which at the time was definitely the most prominent big new theater in Vienna, sort of like the theater that would play contemporary plays, that we would do their posters. And so every 6 weeks or one or so, we showed new posters for the new play to that theater director, and he basically chose one of us. And so this was an incredible opportunity because those posters would be hanging all over Vienna. And we, of course, had a chance to be part of the rehearsals, talk to the directors, talk to the actors, talk to the writers, meet incredible people, but also then again see that these things actually make a difference. And so while I think that probably was as important as going to school.
After graduating, Stefan worked in Hong Kong before taking a job in New York with his design hero, Tibor Kalman. Soon after, he set up his own studio focused on music design.
Well, I was quite glad to open up my own thing, and the idea to start something small and the idea to start something that would literally be concentrating on things for the music industry seemed incredibly delightful to me, because doing album covers was something that I had wanted when I was 15, but then kind of lost track on, or because there were so many other things that were possible in design. And the possibility to really concentrate on that, by that point I was 30 or so, seemed the kind of thing that generated a warm feeling in my belly when I thought about it. So that was it.
I'm absolutely fascinated by the work that your firm initially did, or at least your approach to the work in music, because this was during a time where the main medium through which music was distributed was the CD. And I am kind of at the very end of the last generation of people for whom the CD was still the most, you know, the thing. That's how I got my music when I was younger. And my memories of CDs when I was younger, I thought there were some CDs with some kind of fantastic design features. But it seems to have been completely overlooked as a design object, and indeed kind of denigrated in comparison to the vinyl, of course, but also even the cassette tape, which has made a kind of a comeback in a way that I can't see the CD doing.
Exactly like you say, like, you know, in 93, when we opened the studio, the medium was the CD. What had happened was that record labels treated this new format as sort of the little garbage bin, like, you know, the reissues would basically, they would just take the old album cover, shrink it down from 12-inch to this 5-inch thing, and put it in a plastic box and call it a day. Now, of course, that didn't work. And of course, that looked crappy. And of course, a lot of people were very disappointed by this. And a lot of designers were very disappointed by this. I felt that while the city definitely had some serious disadvantages, mainly that it came in an ugly plastic box, the jewel case, and two, that it had a smaller format, it also offered some serious advantages, mainly that it basically came already with a minimum of an 8-page booklet, but you could easily, it was so cheap to do a 16-page or a 24-page that it wasn't very difficult to talk a record label into doing that. And from that point of view, because you also had a front cover, a back cover, an inside cover, a CD label to do, there were very different storytelling opportunities. So while you definitely lost something quite a bit on the format, there were other things that you could exploit. And I think we took that quite seriously and tried to really then have a much more serious story going on, or you just had so many, many more panels, you had so many more possibilities. Whenever possible, we tried to circumvent the plastic jewel case by working with some sort of cardboard case. That, of course, was much, much, much more trickier because there was a price jump there. The cheapest, easiest way from a record label point of view was a 8-page booklet, 4 colors on one side, 1 color on the inside, a 1-color label, and you always had to fight against that cheapest kind of thing. But whenever we could, and you know, a good number of times we managed to convince them, we went to a more cardboard label, which had, I think, as its main, the cardboard pack or the digipack, which was sort of like a mixture between cardboard and plastic. They just aged much better. The problem of the plastic jewel case was mostly one of aging. That, you know, one of the lovely things about packaging music was that the packaging was very, very much part of the product, and it was not thrown away as one of the few packages. The vinyl cover wasn't thrown away, but also the CD cover really wasn't thrown away. So with that, it of course needed longevity that really played a role. And we tried to give that a pleasant longevity as good as we could.
When you look back on some of those CD designs now, what ones stand out for you?
I think we did some good job on Lou Reed. I mean, definitely set the Twilight Wheeling in that sort of like very dark blue colored plastic box, I think came out really well. I think some of the work we did for David Byrne, both his solo work but also his duo work together with Brian Eno, I think worked well. And I mean, we're definitely, I would say that the status of the studio changed simply because we managed to do a cover for the Stones. It's not one of my favorite covers, but I think that many jobs we got later had something to do with the fact, oh, they also, like the Stones, came to them.
Every 7 years, Stefan takes a sabbatical when he shuts down his studio for an entire year to explore ideas without the pressure of deadlines and client expectations.
Well, I've done 3. So from a date perspective, one was in the 2000, one was 2008, one was 2015. And always a year. The first one was in New York. That it was, I couldn't really think of also going somewhere else. It was so new and at the time also so scary that just doing it in New York was enough. The second one was in Indonesia. The third one was on 3 places, Mexico City, Tokyo, and a tiny village in the Austrian Alps. And they all 3, I think by design, had a different flavor because I didn't want to fall into the trap of repeating the kind of sabbaticals the kind it did. So the first one was very much non-producing, as in the year was pretty much spent thinking about things, catching stuff out, but not really executing them. So I wound up in the first one, I wound up basically with a big sketchbook. The second one in Indonesia was much more producing. I had people, designers working with me in Indonesia. We just didn't work on any client-related stuff. We started the film there. Also, the ideas for the show about happiness was laid there, but we also created things like this table that we have in front of us, or this chair, or there was a whole bunch of furniture that came out of it. And it was quite productive in that we actually executed things. I mean, there were containers and containers of things that came out of Indonesia that were sent here. If I look back now and sort of think about the projects that are close to my heart, what we created in the studio, let's say like that whole series of things I've learned in my life so far, or the happy film, or the exhibition on beauty, things that I find meaningful that we've done them. They all have one thing in common, that they found their initiation in one of the sabbaticals. So in many ways, I found them incredibly helpful.
You mentioned two specific ideas that came out of the two most recent sabbaticals. And the latest one produced a project in collaboration with your partner, Jessica Walsh, on beauty. Now, happiness and beauty are both quite unfashionable concepts within the world of design. Were you conscious of that when you set out to explore them? And did you find that attractive about them?
I would say that definitely would be the case for beauty. Like, meaning I've lived now for 30 years in the design world, and I'm extremely aware of the fact that most designers hate talking about beauty or hate talking about aesthetics in general. It's just not something that's on the forefront of most people. Like, you know, most people specifically, let's say in my profession of communication design, would describe themselves as all sorts of things, like, you know, problem solvers, storytellers, whatnot. But they definitely wouldn't see themselves as somebody who are engaged in beauty. It's a controversial subject, which is sort of crazy, considering it was at the forefront of almost all of production for most of human history.
Sorry, what do you think happened? Why was the concept of beauty kind of dropped from within mainstream design culture?
Well, I think what had happened was a misunderstanding of the early 20th century avant-garde that sometimes very explicitly, sometimes less so, went into a direction of simplicity and function, but took form very, very seriously still. If you look at the beginning of modernism, you know, specifically, let's say, Adolf Loos or even Mies or Corbusier, form played an incredibly big role there. And then some of these ideas of the early avant-garde were misunderstood by the second or third generation after that, specifically after, in the second half of 20th century, as a economic functionalism that really brought this, you know, psychotic sameness that we suffer from today. We made a mistake. Beauty has to be put back in on the same level as function, otherwise we will not create good work. You can see that everywhere, across the board, be it architecture, be it city planning, be it interfaces. This is basically repeated time after time again. And I think even, let's say, if you don't really care about humanity and you say, well, ultimately, I'm just interested in function. Who gives a shit if people feel good doing that or not? Even if that is your stance, you still will not get around beauty, because beauty makes things function much, much better.
And what do you have in store for the rest of your career? What do you want to achieve? What do you hope to achieve? How many sabbaticals do you have left?
Well, I mean, you know, ultimately, of course, I can do whatever I want. So I could also go on, you know, on a sabbatical next year if I wanted to. So it's not like that I'm absolutely bound by this 7-year rhythm. It just basically was that the 7-year rhythm so far has worked best for me. And I would say that I myself ultimately have right now less interest in the commercial world, not because I find that not interesting or not worthwhile of my time. It's just that I've done a lot in that world and I'm probably more stronger my attraction to self-generated projects in that vein of, let's say, a project on beauty, or could also be things that might be smaller than that, is definitely bigger.
That was graphic designer Stefan Sagmeister speaking to Monocle's former producer Henry Rees Sheridan last week in Manhattan. Architecture is about more than creating alluring spaces. Sometimes the form of a building needs to take on a more cerebral role, as a place of reflection, a monument, or an echo of a memory that visitors to that building would like to preserve. One man whose career encapsulates this subtle art perfectly is the British architect Sir David Adjaye. His peerless 2016-built Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington springs to mind as a firm example of the practice. To bring some of his work closer to the public, Adjaye has collaborated with London's Design Museum on a brand new exhibition. It's entitled David Adjaye, Making Memory, which opened at the museum last month. Monocle's Daphne Karnesis, this show's producer, visited the exhibition recently and spoke to one of its curators, Alex Newson.
My name's Alex Newson and I'm a senior curator here at the Design Museum.
The exhibition's been on for a few days now. Is there anything specific that stood out to you in terms of how it was received? Maybe something you read that surprised you?
Actually, as a curator, it's quite hard, actually, because you're trying to control, to a certain extent, the experiences that you want people to have. But then people can enjoy it in so many different ways. That's really good to see that kind of difference in scale across how people see it. But I think the overwhelming thing that I've been pleased with is how people have said that they've felt emotional by engaging with some of the projects, and actually the way we've tried to present them is to kind of really enable that emotional engagement with things and allow people to not necessarily engage just with what the projects in the exhibition look like, but what they mean to people and what they're about. And I think the context behind the events that the buildings and the projects are memorialising is one of the most important things that we've displayed.
Yeah, I definitely felt that as well. So just going to the theme of the exhibition, how did you decide on the theme of monuments and memorials, and how would you define a monument?
Well, the theme came from David, largely, actually. I mean, the exhibition responds to a strand of our programming that is about contemporary practice. We give a designer an opportunity to think in public, and actually we invite someone to present a strand of their research or something that they're currently thinking through as part of their practice and explore it in a live environment. And we put that to David as a very open brief, and he came back with wanting to look at the monument and the memorial, largely because of the work he's been doing with the UK Holocaust Memorial and Learning Centre, but also a number of other projects that he's done throughout his career have in some way engaged with the idea of the monumental and the monument. We talked a lot about what a monument and a memorial is, and actually the difficulty it is in defining them, and actually in a way that's one of the things that the exhibition explores, how we as kind of users of monuments and memorials are changing the way, the form that they take and the way that we interact with them. And I think we're in a moment in time where actually they are being transformed. And we live in a digital age, the age of the internet, where actually we're allowed to have, or we're able to get a plural perspective on anything at the drop of a hat. So actually that has to be reflected in the way that we memorialise things. And actually it's no longer about preserving a particular moment in time or a particular memory, but allowing people to bring their own meaning and their own memory to things.
You were talking before about the different forms that memorials can take. They're not just statues, they're not just tombs or obelisks, as you show in part of the exhibition, going back to ancient times. And you've picked 7 buildings of David's that you've brought to the forefront. How did you go about choosing those specific ones?
There was a lot we could have chosen from his career. He works with monumental things and things to do with memory frequently, actually. It's a very recurring strand in his portfolio. But they were the ones that felt most relevant. They felt most relevant for the exhibition. And they also demonstrated a variety of scale, which is really important. And actually, we have a frieze in the introduction room that shows the different scale that the 7 projects are at, and actually they vary in scale from the kind of the megastructure of the upcoming National Cathedral in Ghana to a very small pop-up pavilion for LDF. But the processes and the sensibilities that are at play with each of those different projects is the same. So actually we really wanted to show it's about a process and a way of interrogating the need and the context behind the memorials that's important, not necessarily the output and the size and the aesthetics of the project.
And what do you think about the, I guess, inherent sort of controversial nature of monuments, things like the reevaluation of historical monuments, particularly in the northwest of the US and Canada, you know, statues of settlers, also in Cape Town, you know, the Rhodes Must Fall protest, the statue of Cecil Rhodes. Do you think that it's something that will always be there? And how do you think that, I guess, Sir David has addressed that in his work?
The context around what we memorialise changes and evolves. Actually, we reevaluate difficult histories as our understanding, our context of them changes. And that's natural, and it's also vital and important. The current controversy around Confederate statues in the US and Cecil Rhodes in places like Oxford and Bristol in the UK are critical. And that's something that we discuss with David a lot, and he feels very strongly about the fact that we should be reinterrogating those histories and representing them in a way that is right for contemporary society and for people today. I guess his projects try to allow for people to bring their own context of things rather than just giving a singular perspective of something. So they allow for that diversity of memory and perspective in the future as well. That's not to say that you can always predict how the context is going to change in the future, but I think the fact that we do live in this kind of like hypermodern age that allows kind of this infinite plurality of perspectives to take place, it definitely plays into his thinking about how he creates them. We're in the room for the Gwangju River Reading Room, which was designed in collaboration with the British-American writer Ty Selassie. And it was a response to the Gwangju uprising in the 1980s. And, I mean, the official estimates are that there were 200 people killed during the uprising, but I think unofficial estimates put it over at way over 2,000. And actually, David and Ty's response to it was to create a reading room and actually create a space where people can come and celebrate and memorialise the acts of literacy and literature in a time of revolution. So they created a space that has 200 books in there that all respond to themes of democracy and social justice.
So we're here in the space of the UK Holocaust Memorial and Learning Centre, which I believe is due to be completed in 2020. Yes. For someone who doesn't know much about the project, what can you tell us and what have you tried to highlight in this room?
One of the things that we did introduce in this room, because it felt particularly relevant, was actually looking at the process of designing very complex public buildings and actually who are the stakeholders involved and what is the process? The design has, I guess, three elements, and that's largely because of the three design partners involved. There's an external memorial, which has been designed by Ron Arad, which is formed of 23 bronze fins that cut through the landscape. And they have 22 channels between them that the visitors use to pass through, and they represent the 22 countries that were directly involved and affected by the Holocaust and had their sort of Jewish communities destroyed. And then visitors will then pass through those and go underground into a subterranean learning centre that's being designed by David Adjaye.
This is what park?
Victoria Tower Gardens, so right next door to Parliament. The location to Parliament's critical, actually, and it was a site that was given to the design team. It wasn't one that they necessarily chose, but one that was chosen before they came on board. But actually, the fact that it is next to Parliament is a project that David's referred to as something that speaks truth to power. It's there as a constant reminder to our chosen seat of democracy that actually we need to stay vigilant.
And Holocaust memorials are sort of notoriously a very sensitive subject. I'm thinking about Peter Eisenman's Holocaust Memorial in Berlin, which has received some criticism over the years for maybe not commemorating the event or the people enough. What do you think about that, and how do you think that it applies to what David's done?
I guess that's why the Learning Centre is so critical to this project, actually. It's not just a memorial, but it's a memorial and learning centre, and that's part of the title and it's part of the design, and it's a way of providing interpretation to the multiple ways in which you can engage with the Holocaust and interpret it, and actually interpret it with relevance to its site and its dialogue with Parliament.
That was Michael's Daphne Karnizes there, speaking to Alex Newson. He's the creator of the exhibition David Adjaye Making Memory, which is on at the Design Museum here in London until May the 5th. And sadly, that's all we have time for on today's show. Don't forget, if you need a little more design-minded inspiration, you could always subscribe to this show's fabulously named sister podcast, On Design Extra, which is available each Thursday. Monocle on Design was produced by Daphne Karnesis and edited by the ever-patient Christy Evans. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.